The Novels of Charles Dickens. An Introduction. Written by David Timpson. Read by Neville Jason. The Mystery of Edwin Drood. In 1869, Dickens began The Mystery of Edwin Drood, his last novel, in a state of complete exhaustion after a grueling tour of public readings that had seriously undermined his constitution. Maybe the collapsed state of his nerves accounts for the dark mood of the book that explores hidden feelings and thoughts of death, and, as Kate Dickens, his daughter, wrote, the tragic secrets of the human heart. Edwin Drood is without doubt Dickens's darkest and most enigmatic novel. Enigmatic inevitably because he died before it was completed. It is half finished, less than 92,000 words, and we have no idea how Dickens intended his story to develop. The dark tone is struck as soon as the novel commences, with an unnamed man in the grips of an opium dream. The setting of the novel builds that sense of darkness and foreboding. The action takes place for the most part in a fictional cathedral town called Cloisterham. Ignored by the developing railway, it is a backwater, dwindling into obscurity and neglect. It is symbolic of decay and destruction, whether self-inflicted, like John Jasper killing himself with opium, or the result of passing time, as in Durdles the Stonemason, whose world is the broken fragments of old tombs, debris, and stone dust. The cathedral is the dead centre of Cloisterham, atrophied and irrelevant. Cloisterham is based on Rochester, where Dickens had lived as a boy, and he seems to be re-examining the idyllic scenes of his childhood in the light of experience. The Rochester of the Pickwick Papers, bustling and full of life, has, for Dickens, decayed into a town of hidden secrets. Dickens' changing view of the town perhaps reflects the changes in his own life. The necessary duality demanded when living a secret life, as he had been now with Ellen Ternan for some years, must have been taking its toll. This novel contains scenes of sexual aggression and frustration which may or may not reflect his own private experiences, though rejection, coldness and indifference had been characteristic of his novels since the affair had begun in 1858. The character of Estella, for instance, in Great Expectations, may be based partly on Ellen. Dickens's poor health was a constant concern during the writing of Edwin Drood. His friend Forster noted, when Dickens read the first instalment to his friends, that he was suffering acute pain in his left arm and foot. A further series of public readings early in 1870 added to the stress of writing the novel. His friends noted he became progressively greyer and thinner, with a haunted look in his eyes. He was, as he had always been, a driven man, but his daughter Kate said any attempt to stay him was as idle as stretching one's hands to a river and bidding it cease to flow. His work was, and always had been, his life. The first instalments showed he had lost none of his popular appeal, selling around 50,000 copies, and it seemed he would have had a big success. He had recaptured his old form, creating comic characters like Durdles and Mrs. Billikin, promising a richness of comic invention to come. But that was not to be. On June the 8th, 1870, he worked a full day in the Swiss chalet in the garden of Gad's Hill, where he always now wrote. Around 6 in the evening, with a final flourish denoting the end of a chapter, Dickens went back to the house for dinner. During the meal, he was taken ill, collapsed, and went into a coma. 24 hours later, on June the 9th, he died. A solitary tear rolled down his cheek moments before he expired. The air of mystery surrounding the novel is compounded by the greater mystery of how Dickens would have developed and ended it. He was aiming to write a detective story, a murder mystery, a sensation novel in the style of his great friend Wilkie Collins, who had already influenced Dickens in the writing of Bleak House and Our Mutual Friend. He imitated his friend's bold style. Opium, for instance, so much a feature of Edwin Drood, also pervades Collins's The Moonstone, written in 1868. Like Collins, too, Dickens filled his plot with red herrings and wrong turnings. With the novel uncompleted, it is impossible to decipher which clues, if any, are genuine. Edwin Drood is supposedly murdered in Chapter 14, and almost any of the characters could be the murderer. Are we to suspect Jasper, who takes an unhealthy interest in his nephew's activities, spies on him, and could have killed him whilst drugged with opium, perhaps? Or the troubled Neville Landless, who takes an instant dislike to Edwin and has difficulty controlling an ungovernable temper? Or are these too obvious as suspects? Would Dickens have revealed a darker side to the muscular Christian Mr. Crisparkle, who equates bodily fitness with spiritual fitness? Theories abound, and have done ever since the novel was published in its unfinished form. Currently, there are more than 100 different endings to the book imagined by scholars and writers. Only Dickens knew the answer. And alas, we shall never know. However, he did suggest one way in a letter to his friend John Forster, and it is with this conclusion that David Timpson, in his recording for Naxos Audiobooks, brings the mystery of Edwin Drood to an end.
The Opium Den.
An ancient English cathedral tower? How can the ancient English cathedral tower be here? The well-known massive grey square tower of its old cathedral? How can that be here? There is no spike of rusty iron in the air between the eye and it from any point of the real prospect. What is the spike that intervenes? And who has set it up? Maybe it is set up by the Sultan's orders for the impaling of a horde of Turkish robbers one by one. It is so, for cymbals clash, and the Sultan goes by to his palace in long procession. 10,000 scimitars flash in the sunlight, and thrice 10,000 dancing girls strew flowers. Then follow white elephants caparisoned in countless gorgeous colours, and infinite in number and attendance. Still the cathedral tower rises in the background, where it cannot be. And still no writhing figure is on the grim spike. Stay. Is the spike so low a thing as the rusty spike on the top of a post of an old bedstead that has tumbled all awry? Some vague period of drowsy laughter must be devoted to the consideration of this possibility. Shaking from head to foot, the man, whose scattered consciousness has thus fantastically pieced itself together, at length rises, supports his trembling frame upon his arms, and looks around. He is in the meanest and closest of small rooms. Through the ragged window curtain, the light of early day steals in from a miserable court. He lies, dressed, across a large unseemly bed, upon a bedstead that has indeed given way under the weight upon it. Lying also dressed, and also across the bed, not longwise, are a Chinaman, a Lascar, and a haggard woman. The two first are in a sleep or stupor. The last is blowing at a kind of pipe to kindle it.
And as she blows, and, shading it with her lean hand, concentrates its red spark of light, it serves in the dim morning as a lamp to show him what he sees of her.
"Another?"
says this woman, in a querulous, rattling whisper.
"Have another?"
He looks about him, with his hand to his forehead.
"You've smoked as many as five since you come in at midnight,"
the woman goes on, as she chronically complains.
"Poor me, poor me, my head is so bad. Them two coming after you. Oh, poor me, the business is slack. Few Chinamen about the docks, and few Lascars, and no ships coming in, these say. Here's another ready for you, dearie. You'll remember, like a good soul, won't you, that the market price is dreadful high just now, more than 3 shillings and 6 pence for a thimbleful. And you'll remember that nobody but me and Jack Chinaman t'other side the court, but he can't do it as well as me, as the true secret of mixing it. You'll pay up accordingly, dearie, won't you?"
She blows at the pipe as she speaks, and occasionally, bubbling at it, inhales much of its contents.
Oh, me, me lungs is weak, me lungs is bad. It's nearly ready for you, dearie. Ah, poor me, my poor hand shakes like to drop off. I see you coming too, and I says to me poor self, I'll have another ready for him, and he'll bear in mind the market price of opium, and pay according. Oh, my poor head! I makes me pipes of old penny ink bottles, you see, dearie. This is one, and I fits in a mouthpiece this way, and I takes me mixture out of this thimble with this little horn spoon, and so I fills, dearie. Oh, me poor nerves! I got heavens hard drunk for 16 year afore I took to this, but this don't hurt me, not to speak of, and it takes away the hunger as well as wittles, dearie."
She hands him the nearly emptied pipe and sinks back, turning over on her face. Edwin and Neville. The two young men, having seen the damsels, their charges, into the courtyard of the nun's house, and finding themselves coldly stared at by the brazen doorplate, as if the battered old beau with the glass in his eye were insolent, look at one another, look along the perspective of the moonlit street, and slowly walk away together.
"Do you stay here long, Mr. Drood?" says Neville.
"Not this time," is the careless answer. "I leave for London again tomorrow, but I shall be here off and on until next midsummer. Then I shall take my leave of Cloisterham, and England too, for many a long day, I expect."
"Are you going abroad?"
"Going to wake up Egypt a little," is the condescending answer.
"Are you reading?"
"Reading?" repeats Edwin Drood with a touch of contempt. "No, doing, working, engineering. My small patrimony was left a part of the capital of the firm I am with by my father, a former partner, and I am a charge upon the firm until I come of age, and then I step into my modest share in the concern. Jack, you met him at dinner, is, until then, my guardian and trustee."
"I heard from Mr. Crisparkle of your other good fortune."
"What do you mean by my other good fortune?" Neville has made his remark in a watchfully advancing and yet furtive and shy manner, very expressive of that peculiar air already noticed of being at once hunter and hunted. Edwin has made his retort with an abruptness not at all polite. They stop and interchange a rather heated look.
"I hope," says Neville, "there is no offence, Mr. Drood, in my innocently referring to your betrothal."
"By George!" cries Edwin, leading on again at a somewhat quicker pace.
Everybody in this chattering old cloisterum refers to it. I wonder no public house has been set up with my portrait for the sign of the betrothed's head, or Pussy's portrait, one or the other. I am not accountable for Mr. Crisparkle's mentioning the matter to me quite openly, Neville begins. No, that's true, you are not, Edwin Drood assents. But, resumes Neville, I am accountable for mentioning it to you, and I did so on the supposition that you could not fail to be highly proud of it. Now, there are these two curious touches of human nature working the secret springs of this dialogue. Neville Landless is already enough impressed by Little Rosebud to feel indignant that Edwin Drood, far below her, should hold his prize so lightly. Edwin Drood is already enough impressed by Helena to feel indignant that Helena's brother, far below her, should dispose of him so coolly and put him out of the way so entirely. However, the last remark had better be answered. So, says Edwin, I don't know, Mr. Neville, adopting that mode of address from Mr. Crisparkle, that what people are proudest of they usually talk most about. I don't know either that what they are proudest of they most like other people to talk about. But I live a busy life, and I speak under correction by you readers who ought to know everything, and I dare say do. By this time they had both become savage. Mr. Neville out in the open, Edwin Drood under the transparent cover of a popular tune, and a stop now and then to pretend to admire picturesque effects in the moonlight before him. "It does not seem to me very civil in you," remarks Neville at length, "to reflect upon a stranger who comes here, not having had your advantages, to try to make up for lost time. But to be sure, I was not brought up in busy life, and my ideas of civility were formed among heathens. Perhaps the best civility, whatever kind of people we are brought up among," retorts Edwin Drood, "is to mind our own business. If you will set me that example, I promise to follow it." "Do you know that you take a great deal too much upon yourself?" is the angry rejoinder, "and that in the part of the world I come from you would be called to account for it?" "By whom, for instance?" asks Edwin Drood, coming to a halt and surveying the other with a look of disdain. But here a startling right hand is laid on Edwin's shoulder, and Jasper stands between them. For it would seem that he, too, has strolled round by the nun's house and has come up behind them on the shadowy side of the road. "Ned, Ned, Ned," he says, "we must have no more of this. I don't like this. I have overheard high words between you two. Remember, my dear boy, you are almost in the position of host tonight. You belong, as it were, to the place, and in a manner represent it towards a stranger. Mr. Neville is a stranger, and you should respect the obligations of hospitality. And Mr. Neville," laying his left hand on the inner shoulder of that young gentleman, and thus walking on between them, hand to shoulder on either side, "you will pardon me, but I appeal to you to govern your temper, too. Now what is amiss?" "But why ask? Let there be nothing amiss, and the question is superfluous. We are all three on a good understanding, are we not?" After a silent struggle between the two young men who shall speak last, Edwin Drood strikes in with, "So far as I am concerned, Jack, there is no anger in me." "Nor in me," says Neville Landless, though not so freely, or perhaps so carelessly.
Mrs. Billikins and Miss Twinkleton.
She has never seen him since the fatal night, except when she was questioned before the mayor, and then he was present in gloomy watchfulness as representing his lost nephew and burning to avenge him. She hangs her garden hat on her arm and goes out. The moment she sees him from the porch, leaning on the sundial, the old horrible feeling of being compelled by him asserts its hold upon her. She feels that she would even then go back, but that he draws her feet towards him. She cannot resist, and sits down with her head bent on the garden seat beside the sundial. She cannot look up at him for abhorrence, but she has perceived that he is dressed in deep mourning. So is she. It was not so at first, but the lost has long been given up and mourned for as dead. He would begin by touching her hand. She feels the intention and draws her hand back. His eyes are then fixed upon her. She knows, though her own see nothing but the grass.
"I have been waiting," he begins, "for some time to be summoned back to my duty near you."
After several times forming her lips, which she knows he is closely watching, into the shape of some other hesitating reply, and then into none, she answers,
"Duty, sir?"
"The duty of teaching you, serving you as your faithful music master."
"I have left off that study."
"Not left off, I think. Discontinued, I was told by your guardian, that you discontinued it under the shock that we have all felt so acutely. When will you resume?"
"Never, sir."
"Never? You could have done no more if you had loved my dear boy."
"I did love him,"
cried Rosa with a flash of anger.
"Yes, but not quite in the right way, shall I say. Not in the intended and expected way. Much as my dear boy was unhappily too self-conscious and self-satisfied, I'll draw no parallel between him and you in that respect, to love as he should have loved, or as anyone in his place would have loved, must have loved."
She sits in the same still attitude, but shrinking a little more.
"Then to be told that you discontinued your study with me was to be politely told that you abandoned it altogether," he suggested.
"Yes," says Rosa with sudden spirit. "The politeness was my guardian's, not mine. I told him that I was resolved to leave off, and that I was determined to stand by my resolution."
"And you still are?"
"I still am, sir, and I beg not to be questioned any more about it. At all events, I will not answer any more. I have that in my power."
She is so conscious of his looking at her with a gloating admiration of the touch of anger on her, and the fire and animation it brings with it, that even as her spirit rises, it falls again, and she struggles with a sense of shame, affront, and fear, much as she did that night at the piano.
"I will not question you any more, since you object to it so much. I will confess—"
"I do not wish to hear you, sir,"
cries Rosa, rising. This time he does touch her with his outstretched hand. In shrinking from it, she shrinks into her seat again.
"We must sometimes act in opposition to our wishes," he tells her in a low voice. "You must do so now, or do more harm to others than you can ever set right."
"What harm?"
"Presently. Presently. You question me, you see, and surely that's not fair when you forbid me to question you. Nevertheless, I will answer the question presently. Dearest Rosa, charming Rosa."
She starts up again. This time he does not touch her, but his face looks so wicked and menacing as he stands leaning against the sundial setting, as it were his black mark upon the very face of day, that her flight is arrested by horror as she looks at him.
"I do not forget how many windows command a view of us," he says, glancing towards them. "I will not touch you again. I will come no nearer to you than I am. Sit down, and there will be no mighty wonder in your music masters leaning idly against a pedestal and speaking with you, remembering all that has happened and our shares in it. Sit down, my beloved."
She would have gone once more, was all but gone, and once more his face, darkly threatening what would follow if she went, has stopped her. Looking at him, with the expression of the instant frozen on her face, she sits down on the seat again.
"Rosa, even when my dear boy was affianced to you, I loved you madly. Even when I thought his happiness in having you for his wife was certain, I loved you madly. Even when I strove to make him more ardently devoted to you, I loved you madly. Even when he gave me the picture of your lovely face, so carelessly traduced by him, which I feigned to hang always in my sight for his sake, but worshipped in torment for years, I loved you madly.
in the distasteful work of the day, in the wakeful misery of the night, girded by sordid realities, or wandering through paradises and hells of visions into which I rushed, carrying your image in my arms. I loved you madly. If anything could make his words more hideous to her than they are in themselves, it would be the contrast between the violence of his look and delivery and the composure of his assumed attitude.
Rosa and Jasper.
But the Billikin had somehow come to the knowledge that Miss Twinkleton kept a school. The leap from that knowledge to the inference that Miss Twinkleton set herself to teach her something was easy.
"But you don't do it," soliloquised the Billikin. "I am not your pupil, whatever she," meaning Rosa, "may be, poor thing."
Miss Twinkleton, on the other hand, having changed her dress and recovered her spirits, was animated by a bland desire to improve the occasion in all ways, and to be as serene a model as possible. In a happy compromise between her two states of existence, she had already become, with her work-basket before her, the equably vivacious companion, with a slight judicious flavouring of information, when the Billikin announced herself.
"I will not hide from you, ladies," said the bee, enveloped in the shawl of state, "for it is not my character to hide, neither me motives nor me actions, that I take the liberty to look in upon you to express a hope that your dinner was to your liking. Though not professed, but plain, still her wages should be a sufficient object to her to stimulate to soar above mere roast and biled."
"We dined very well indeed," said Rosa. "Thank you."
"Accustomed," said Miss Twinkleton with a gracious air, which to the jealous ears of the Billikin seemed to add, "My good woman," "accustomed to a liberal and nutritious, yet plain and salutary diet, we have found no reason to bemoan our absence from the ancient city and the methodical household in which the quiet routine of our lot has been hitherto cast."
"I did think it well to mention to my cook," observed the Billikin, with a gush of candour, "which I hope you will agree with Miss Twinkleton was a right precaution, that the young lady, being used to what we should consider here but poor diet, had better be brought forward by degrees. For a rush from scanty feeding to generous feeding, and from what you may call messing to what you may call method, do require a power of constitution, which is not often found in youth, particular when undermined by boarding school."
It will be seen that the Billikin now openly pitted herself against Miss Twinkleton, as one whom she had fully ascertained to be her natural enemy.
"Your remarks," returned Miss Twinkleton, "from a remote moral eminence, are well meant, I have no doubt, but you will permit me to observe that they develop a mistaken view of the subject, which can only be imputed to your extreme want of accurate information."
"My information," retorted the Billikin, throwing in an extra syllable for the sake of emphasis, at once polite and powerful, "my information, Miss Twinkleton, were my own experience, which I believe is usually considered to be good guidance. But whether so or not, I was put in youth to a very genteel boarding school, the mistress being no less a lady than yourself, of about your own age, or it may be some years younger, and a poorness of blood flowed from the table which has run through my life."
"Very likely," said Miss Twinkleton, still from her distant eminence, "and very much to be deplored. Rosa, my dear, how are you getting on with your work?"
"Miss Twinkleton," resumed the Billikin in a courtly manner, "before retiring on the int as a lady should, I wish to ask of yourself as a lady whether I am to consider that my words is doubted."
"I am not aware on what ground you cherish such a supposition,"
began Miss Twinkleton, when the Billikin neatly stopped her. "Do not, if you please, put suppositions betwixt my lips where none such have been imparted by myself. Your flow of words is great, Miss Twinkleton, and no doubt is expected from you by your pupils, and no doubt is considered worth the money. No doubt, I'm sure, but not paying for flows of words, and not asking to be favoured with them here, I wish to repeat my question."
"If you refer to the poverty of your circulation," began Miss Twinkleton, when again the Billikin neatly stopped her,
"I have used no such expressions."
"If you refer, then, to the poorness of your blood?"
"Brought upon me," stipulated the Billikin expressly, "at a boarding school."
"Then," resumed Miss Twinkleton, "all I can say is that I am bound to believe, on your asseveration, that it is very poor indeed. I cannot forbear adding that if that unfortunate circumstance influences your conversation, it is much to be lamented, and it is eminently desirable that your blood were richer. Rosa, my dear, how are you getting on with your work?"
"Before retiring, miss," proclaimed the Billikin to Rosa, loftily cancelling Miss Twinkleton, "I should wish it to be understood between yourself and me that my transactions in future is with you alone. I know no elderly lady here, miss, none older than yourself."
"A highly desirable arrangement, Rosa, my dear," observed Miss Twinkleton.
"It is not, miss," said the Billikin with a sarcastic smile, "that I possess the mill I have heard of, in which old single ladies could be ground up young. What a gift it would be to some of us! But that I limit myself to you totally."
"When I have any desire to communicate a request to the person of the house, Rosa, my dear," observed Miss Twinkleton with majestic cheerfulness, "I will make it known to you, and you will kindly undertake, I am sure, that it is conveyed to the proper quarter."
"Good evening, miss," said the Billikin at once affectionately and distantly. "Being alone in my eyes, I wish you good evening with best wishes, and do not find myself drove, I am truly happy to say, into expressing my contempt for an individual, unfortunately for yourself, belonging to you."
The Billikin gracefully withdrew with this parting speech, and from that time Rosa occupied the restless position of shuttlecock between these two battledores.
These extracts have been taken from the unabridged recording of The Mystery of Edwin Drood, read by David Timson for Naxos Audiobooks.